But today what I thought I would do, and maybe I wish I would have announced this earlier, spend a bit of time talking about, you know, what is the value of pursuing an MBA? As many of you know, my career has been spent housed in a business school. Those of you who follow my academic work know that I apply evolutionary psychology and evolutionary biology to study human behavior in general and consumer and economic behavior in particular. So that's why I'm housed in a business school. So some of the courses that I teach include things like consumer behavior at the undergraduate level, consumer behavior at the MBA level. I've taught consumer psychology and psychology of decision making at the Masters of Science and PhD level. For the past few years, I've taught an Understanding Our Consuming Instinct course at the undergraduate level, which is a course where I demonstrate how you apply evolutionary psychology and consumer behavior. Then I've also, so this has been at my university, Concordia University, but I've also been a visiting professor at, you know, several major American universities, at UC Irvine, at Dartmouth College, so the Tuck School of Business, and also at Cornell, my alma mater, the Johnson School, Johnson Graduate School of Management. And there I've also taught, you know, consumer behavior, I've taught marketing research, and at UC Irvine I also taught international marketing, which was the only time that I ever taught this course. This was back at when I was a visiting professor for 2 years at UC Irvine. Next year, actually, I'll be teaching some new courses that I've never taught before. I'll have more to say about that in a while. So that gives you a bit of a sense of my background in terms of being housed in a business school. But then the next question is, well, did I pursue an MBA? And so this leads us to the question of, is an MBA worth doing? And of course, as someone who loves education, who believes that all other things equal, more education is always better than less education, if pursued properly and under the right conditions, then of course an MBA could be extremely valuable. And now I'm not talking about extrinsic value in the sense of, oh, you know, if you have MBA after your name, you're more likely to get that promotion. That's really not what I want to spend my time talking about. I'm talking more about the purity of the process. Is there intrinsic value? Are there intrinsic rewards in pursuing an MBA? And notwithstanding the fact that many students regrettably pursue an MBA only because it's a means to an end, the original vision of an MBA was that, you know, you'd have people who were technically trained. Imagine you're an engineer who, okay, you've spent quite a few years doing, you know, technical work as an engineer out of your undergrad in engineering, but now you want to move on to a more managerial role. You work at Boeing, and you now want to no longer be the one who is doing the calculations and you know, and aerodynamics, but you now want to be leading a team of 60 engineers that involves all sorts of business decisions. Well, then you would go off and do an MBA, and there'd be great value in that, because in your technical training, you wouldn't have seen all the types of courses that you know, you expect to know in from a business school perspective. So in my case, for example, I did an undergrad in mathematics and computer science, and so I was the ideal guy to then go ahead and pursue an MBA. Now, there is a lot less added value in doing an MBA if you already have an undergraduate in business. So originally, in many cases, it was, as I said, you have a technical background, and then you go to graduate school, you go to business school, in the same way that you go to other professional schools, you go to medical school, you go to law school. And that was really, the idea was, it was graduate training. So many of the most prestigious business schools don't have undergraduate programs in business. It's meant to be MBA or higher. But then, of course, you know, undergraduate MBA degrees started developing, and that's perfectly fine. You can have a very good undergraduate degree in business, But then the question becomes, how much added value do you get if you do an MBA after an undergraduate degree? Well, you can. If, let's say, in your undergrad, you specialize very much in finance and economics, and then in your MBA, you want to specialize in marketing, well, then there might be value. But all things told, the most bang for your buck you're going to get with an MBA is if you pursue it after a technical degree. Now, in most cases, the typical profile of an MBA student is someone who has been, you know, out of undergrad 4 or 5 years. So typically, I mean, it's not a steadfast rule, but your typical MBA student might be in their late 20s, maybe early 30s. Whereas, for example, in my case, I went straight. I was one of the only, maybe even the only student in my MBA class to get in straight out of my undergrad. So I didn't take a break after my undergrad. I went straight for my MBA. So that's the first general issue. Yes, MBA can be great, especially if you're coming from a technical background. Number two, as in most things in life, you know, you really get out of the experience what you put into it. So if you pursue an MBA and you take largely soft classes, you know, how to love your employee, you know, and so on. Well, that's nice. It's all nice and good, but you really want to use your time in school to be learning the knowledge that you otherwise are unlikely to pick up, you know, week one in your workforce, right? So that's why I always tell my students, try as much as you can to take quantitative courses, right? So if you're thinking, for example, of doing a marketing degree, in marketing there are courses that are you know, less quantitative and more quantitative. Not to imply that non-quantitative courses are not important, right? I mean, I teach consumer psychology, which is, you know, involves studying, you know, how do we develop persuasive messages, let's say, in an advertisement? What are the types of, you know, decision rules that consumers use? So it's very much rooted in cognitive psychology and social psychology, and in my case, evolutionary psychology. But it's also very good to take quantitative courses. So, for example, you're taking big data analytics. Now, and today, of course, with AI, you can have AI applications in business settings, right? Or in my case, for example, in my MBA degree, I did a mini thesis, a 6-credit thesis in operations research, which is an applied mathematics field. I studied a problem called the two-dimensional cutting stock problem, which is a problem that arises in many industries where you have, say, in the wood industry, the metal industry, and the glass industry, where you have this raw resource, let's say sheets of metal or sheets of wood or sheets of glass, and you get an order from a client, I'd like 70 X by X squares to be cut, and I need 30 A by B rectangles to be cut. And then the question becomes, how do you lay out those cuts for a given client's order as to minimize the waste of the raw material? It's a very, very important problem that has huge bottom line implications, right? Because if you don't lay the guillotine cuts properly, then you end up losing a lot of money, unless you're able to somehow salvage the wasted resource. And so that was a problem that I had studied for a few years as a research assistant, and I ended up writing up a thesis on that. So even though I was doing an MBA, given that I had a mathematics, computer science background, I still took hard courses. I don't mean hard in that they're difficult, although they were, but I took hard quantitative courses. I took a quantitative marketing course. But, you know, even the first year courses that all MBA students take, financial accounting and managerial accounting and finance and microeconomics and macroeconomics, organizational behavior, all these courses, they're indispensable if you know to truly understand the totality of how business works. And so there's definitely great intrinsic value in pursuing an MBA. But then again, here's where I'm going to get a bit critical, because a lot of MBA programs have become astoundingly watered down programs. And I've talked about this on many occasions. I even had written a highly popular Psychology Today article many years ago where I basically said, I can't remember the exact title of the article, but something like, I'll have a hamburgers, fries, hold the pickles, and an MBA. And there what I was saying facetiously is that if you look at the requirements for completing an MBA in terms of the number of credits you have to complete at the time when I did the MBA. So I did my MBA from 88 to 90. I graduated with my MBA in 1990. And if you look at many MBA programs today, the programs are, in many cases, at least one third fewer credits. I think in my case, if I'm going on memory here, I think I had to do 67 credits, which is incredibly heavy load. It's two full years of five, six, seven graduate courses a semester, right? I mean, many people can't handle taking four graduate courses in one semester. And these are really heavy courses, managerial accounting and finance and microeconomics and macroeconomics and so on. Come do MBA with us. It'll only take you 12 months. Okay, well, we've got even an accelerated MBA. It's 10 months. Come do the MBA with us. It's 6 weekends. Come do the MBA with us. It's just a drive-through and you can get a burger at the same time. Okay, it's too much for you to do a drive-by. Get a car wash. And if your car wash meets your satisfaction, you also pick up an MBA. And now, of course, the argument there is always, well, you know, people are busy and they don't have time anymore to spend so many years. And so you respond to market conditions. Bullshit, right? That's what it means to have intrinsic value. You don't water down the academic requirements of a degree because you have to respond to market conditions. It's just a death spiral to the bottom. It's a race to the bottom. So universities have this desperate need to attract students. And so one of the ways that they do that is they keep watering down the amount of credits you have to complete in order. So now you have executive MBA. Well, you don't have to really come to school. Just every eighth weekend, you have a one-day retreat. And that 24 hours of spending together, counts as a semester. And so, you know, just get together three times, play golf, and you have an executive MBA degree. No. It shouldn't be that what is required to complete an MBA changes within one or two generations and changes drastically, right? It's not they've taken out this course and replaced it by that course. I mean, by the way, this is also happening in medicine. Historically, medicine was always a four-year degree, MD degree, and now some schools are reducing it to 3 years, accelerated. Okay, so yes, intrinsically, you can pursue an MBA. It can give you great value. If you choose the right courses, you can certainly learn a lot. So I want to maybe take a minute or two telling you about some of the incredible courses that I took in my electives, right? So as you might imagine, in the first year of the MBA, a real MBA, a two-year full-time MBA, you're taking a lot of the core courses that everyone takes. And then in your second year, you end up specializing in different courses depending on your interests. One of the courses that till today remains, you know, one of the courses that I found most personally enriching was a course called Group Dynamics, which I took with Professor Jay Conger, who had also been my professor in the first year of the MBA. He taught the core organizational behavior course. And Jay and I subsequently became friends. He's now, after he left McGill, he went to one of the seven sister colleges, McKenna something in LA. And so we've stayed in touch, and he's a wonderful guy. His main area of research is on leadership and whether leaders are made or whether they're born, right? So it's the old nature-nurture debate when it comes to leadership. So Jay was a great professor, but in the second year of the MBA, he taught a course called Group Dynamics, which was one of the most sought-after courses. Everybody wanted to take that course, but you had to go through a rigorous application process because he only picked, I think if memory serves me right, either 5 or 6 students in a class. And those people would become the group that would, you know, effectively go through a whole group therapy session throughout the semester with of course, Jay serving as the director, the orchestrator of the group dynamics. And it's a course where, I mean, as the term says, I mean, it's learning about group dynamics, but learning about yourself. So I remember very vividly and I actually talk about this in the Parasitic Mind briefly. If I remember, I can't remember, I think it was in chapter 1, where I'm talking about the idea that, so there's something called transactional analysis from psychoanalysis. I think it's Eric Byrne. I'm really going here on references from many, many years ago, where he basically argued, so scripts that people play, the idea being that the lives that we lead are akin in part to how an actor is given a script, right? Here's the script that you're going to play in your character as the Bond villain. And so the idea then becomes that scripts that people play in transactional analysis is that the idea that, for example, you might be given a script from your parents that says, you are the great hope of the family. We expect you to become a physician or an engineer, and you're the great hope out of the misery that we've had. You're going to be the first person to graduate from university. So, of course, there's an element that's just your nature, your innate forces, but there's this other nurture element whereby you're handed a script that might shape the types of decisions that you make in your life. And so as we went through that course, which, as I said, is effectively this really very deep and profound group therapy session, we had to write a paper as part of our final requirements for that course, where we shared what are the key scripts that define our life's trajectory, right? And so if you remember, those of you who read The Parasitic Mind, I talked about that two of the innate ideals that shape my personhood as I tackle life are truth and freedom. So it's in that context that I mentioned that course. The other assignment that we had to do in that group dynamics course I think the gentleman's name was Don Rizzo, if I'm not mistaken. He had this theory about various personality types and offshoots of these personality types. And so you had to read that book and then explain what was your personality type, what were the offshoots. I can't remember what the term in the book was, maybe the tangents or the, I can't remember the term. I think the guy's name is Don Rizzo. Again, I'm going here on memory from 35 years ago. Yes, I was a very, very good student. And then not only you had to tell in the paper what your personality type was based on that taxonomy, but you then had to predict what all the other members of your group's personality types were by virtue of you having been in this very intimate group dynamics, group therapy course for the entire MBA semester. And then the question becomes, was there convergent validity? In other words, did everybody within the group predict that Gad Saad had exactly that personality type? Or was there a discordant, view across people and so on? So it was an incredibly powerful exercise. And again, this is something that I took, in my MBA, which was very, very psychological, very profound, very psychoanalytic. We were sworn to secrecy, akin to how a therapist and a client or a patient would have to face. And of course, I've never discussed any of the details or any of the people before, and so on. And I wouldn't. But it was so powerful. I mean, people would break down. Everything that you might expect in a group therapy session, and that happened within the context of an MBA degree. I did another course with a professor whom I got to know later on a personal level as a friend, Amitava Chattopadhyay, who taught a course called Marketing Communications, where we ended up doing a research project. I remember. I mean, I wish some of my former professors would be listening now to appreciate that I'm recounting these stories nearly four decades after they took place. And so I remember in my marketing communications course, we had to do a final project where we wanted to understand what are the reasons why people might not sign an organ donor card if they were to, for example, tragically pass away in an accident, right? If they were to die, what would be the reasons why you wouldn't do that? Given that, you know, you can benefit other people, you can, you know, your tragic death might cause many other people to survive. And the idea was, of course, that by understanding what are the obstacles that stops people from signing those donor cards, then you can develop persuasion messages that cater to these. And so that was an incredible project, right? I mean, it was certainly social marketing. It was health marketing. You had to study how to collect data, how to design instruments to understand people's motives, or in this case, their reticence to do something. How do you then develop a message that tries to persuade them otherwise? So again, I'll mention in a second one other course, although I could spend another 5 hours talking about, you know, all these amazing courses that I've taken. But my point here is that the reason why I was a unique student and that I was, you know, very academically oriented. I knew that I was going to become a professor, so I was very, very intrinsically motivated. But the fact that I am able, just on a whim, you know, recount these stories, it's not like I went into an archive and I generated these stories. I'm just whipping these out from my memory. Well, shows how, you know, important those learning experiences were to me. So if you pursue an MBA because you just want to scam it, you want to do a 30-minute MBA at some bullshit school so that you can get the title MBA after your name, well, then probably this conversation is not for you. But if you are someone serious, then there is no reason to think that an MBA is just some, you know, professional designation. You could really, there are some incredibly deep, technical, powerful courses that you could take. I'll mention one other quick story during my MBA, and then maybe I'll just, you know, talk about what types of schools you can go to and so on, and then, you know, we can call it a day. By the way, I see that there are a few requests. I don't take questions here in the open session. If you do wish to ask me questions as relating to this session, you can subscribe to my exclusive content. There is a thread where you can post your question, and then I will go there until 9:15 tonight. If you get your question before then, I will write my response individualized to you. So apologies, but I'm not taking any questions here. So I had taken a managerial negotiations course. I'm not sure how many, I'm not even sure if I've ever mentioned this publicly. And if I haven't, boy, you're getting first dibs on it. So I was taking a managerial negotiations course, and I'll even tell you the professor's name, and I swear to God, to the cosmos, that I'm not looking up my former transcripts. It's straight from memory. His name was David Saunders. He went on, I'd like to think that he'd be very happy to know that I remember his name 35 years later. So first day, I walk into this managerial negotiations course, and we had this class-wide negotiations exercise to do where, you know, the whole class had to go through these negotiations, and then at the end of it, they'd be, you know, a winner, a singular winner of the entire exercise. So the first week, yours truly, Dr. Goodlooks, wins the negotiations exercise. Week two, different exercise, but same principle. Dr. Goodlooks wins the exercise of that day. So the professor comes up to me very gingerly, maybe even back then it would have been triggering to ask about someone's background, although it wasn't nearly as bad as it is today. He approached me. He goes, do you mind if I ask what your background is? And I said, oh, what do you mean, professor? Like my academic background? Oh, I studied before my MBA mathematics and computer science. He goes, no. I don't mean your academic background. What's your ethnic background? You know, I mean, I guess you could tell that I'm not original. I'm not John Smith or whatever indigenous person or whatever. I said, oh, my background. We're Lebanese. Actually, I'm Lebanese Jewish. He goes, wait. You're Lebanese and you're Jewish and you're in a negotiations class. What is it that I can teach you? Of course, we both laughed. It was funny. Now, of course, today that would be, he'd be fired for having promulgated a stereotype about the negotiating mercantile Phoenician Lebanese guy. But the point was that, yeah, maybe it's in my blood that, you know, we know how to, you know, negotiate well. So to summarize all this, MBA can be an amazing experience. It could be an enriching experience, especially, as I said, if you're coming from a technical background. If you take the right courses, it could be incredibly rewarding. If you do the real MBA, full MBA, not some watered down, you know, 5% version of a real MBA. Now, in terms of which schools to go to, look, here, the answer here is one that's more extrinsically related in that, yes, if you get an MBA from MIT or Stanford or Cornell, my alma mater, or Harvard, yes, that opens you up to a lot more interviews from specific types of schools. Many schools, companies, post your MBA. The idea being that just like, for example, law school, it's very, very hard to get certain interviews or, you know, internships with certain law firms in New York if you don't come from one of, you know, six or seven typically Ivy League law schools. And so, yes, there is a signal there. Now, of course, there are, you know, the top business schools in the world. By the way, actually, the school that I'm at, the John Molson School of Business, is consistently ranked in the top 3-4 business schools in Canada and in the top like 70 or so in the world. So it's a world-renowned business school. Actually, the business school of my university is more globally renowned than the brand name of my university. So many people would know McGill University, which is another English school in Montreal. They would know McGill more than they know Concordia. But when it comes to the John Molson School of Business, it's actually, you know, it's punching above its weight class, as they say. So which school to go to, it really depends. Of course, there is a question of money. Many of the elite private schools are exorbitantly expensive. That doesn't mean that you can't go to a in-state state college. You know, you could go to Purdue University or Ohio State University. If you're in California, you can go to UC Berkeley, which is a state school, a public school, or you go to University of Michigan, which is also a public school. It's a top school. I gave 2 talks at University of Michigan after my first book came out, The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption. One talk was at the Ross School of Business. The other one was at the psychology department. And, you know, top school. So there are ways by which you can still attend top universities or top business schools, even if you're not super wealthy, and that you can go the public route. You know, University of Florida has a good business school. As I said, University of Michigan, UC Berkeley, UCLA, all of these are ultimately public schools versus, say, Duke or MIT or Cornell or University of Chicago. Of course, if you're interested in economics, University of Chicago is historically the place to be. So, you know, it's tough to advise you as to which school to go to, but to kind of conclude, before I conclude, I want to mention one other thing. At my own university, in my own school, we actually have, so we have an undergraduate in business. You know, you can specialize in marketing or finance or accounting or supply chain management or management, organizational behavior, and so on. Or, so that's undergrad. Then, of course, we have the MBA. We also have a PhD, which typically takes about, I mean, if you're very, very quick, 4 years, typically takes five, many times, oftentimes takes longer. This is full-time, of course. Most PhDs go on for academic positions, of course. But the reason I'm mentioning all this is because at the master's level, we have something quite unique at my school, which a few other schools have, a growing number of schools are now doing. We have an MSc. I mean, in the American context, you would just call it MS, Masters of Science. In Canada, we follow the British system. We add the C, MSc for Masters of Science. The Masters of Science is actually quite different from the MBA. The MBA is a generalist degree. So, you know, it's like going to medical school or going to law school. You've got your 2 years, you take your whole bunch of courses. It's just basically typically courses. You pass those courses and you go on to the next courses. The MSc is like a thesis-based program, like you would have in other MAs or MS programs. You take typically 1 year of coursework, and these are usually much more research seminars. So you're actually, as part of the required readings in the courses, you're actually reading scientific academic papers. And then you have to do a thesis, a full-blown master's thesis with a supervisor. So it's smaller in scope than, of course, a doctoral dissertation, but it's a full thesis. So I've supervised, several master's theses, and some of those works, I place the quality bar very high. And so some of those works have subsequently led to publications in top journals with the student that I supervised in various top journals. And so the benefit of doing an MSc are multifold. Number one, remember earlier I was saying that, for example, if you already have an undergrad, you may not want to do an MBA. Well, an undergrad in business, I mean. Well, one of the things that the MSc allows you to do if you want to avoid having another generalist degree, the MSc grants you a specialization imprimatur because you are specializing by virtue of you doing a thesis, by definition, in a very specialized and narrow topic. So let's suppose you're interested in international advertising, okay? So that way, when you finish your MSc, it's not as though you might go into investment banking or McKinsey Consulting or, right? Your passion is you want to be a marketing researcher within, a global international marketing context. Well, maybe you're going to do a thesis on some international marketing topic. You might study, do fear-based appeals, meaning advertisements that use fear as part of the copy of the ad. Are they as effective across cultural settings? I just made that up, okay? Well, that might become a thesis topic, and then you'll end up, proposing a set of hypotheses, designing the data collection instruments, collecting the data, conducting literature review, analyzing the data, arriving at conclusions, very much what you do when you publish an academic paper, a scientific paper. So the beauty of doing an MSc is if you think that you'd like to have a specialization orientation prior to going out into the job market after completing a graduate degree in business, then the MSc becomes really attractive. And now there aren't as many MSc programs in business schools as there are, of course, MBA programs, but they're growing in number. And so that might be, for some of you, a very attractive option rather than the more generalist MBA. So to conclude, yes, an MBA could be very rewarding. Independently of the fact that, yes, you might get a salary bump, it could be a very rewarding intellectual experience if you choose the right program, if you take the right courses, it could be very enriching and intellectually challenging. Which school you go to, of course, depends on a whole range of issues. But, you know, of course, depending on how much, what your, budget is, what, how good your background is, your grades are. Many of these programs are very, very competitive to get into. It's not very easy to get into many of these top business schools. Yeah, so that's it. Hope I've answered some of your lingering questions about the value of an MBA. From my perspective, from the perspective of the professor, there are good aspects in teaching MBA students and regrettably some less than good ones. The good part is that, of course, the students are a lot more mature. They usually have a lot more experience in that they've been out there in the workforce for, as I said, 4, 5, 6 years. That's great. Given that they're doing an MBA and, you know, given that it's quite selective to get into good business schools, you know, you expect them on average to be quite studious, quite intelligent, quite hardworking. The difficulty with the MBAs, and that's only gotten worse with the growing sense of entitlement, is that it's often difficult to deal with MBAs because they truly have internalized the customer is king ethos. And that doesn't work well with Dr. Goodlooks, right? No, I will not design different schedules for the exam to suit each of your travel schedules. There's this thing called the course outline. That course outline stipulates exactly when we're meeting. You decide if it coincides or conflicts with your work schedule. If it does, then you end up not taking the course. You know what that's called? It's called life. So no, I will not be providing 7 different time periods for you to take your exam. No, I will not fudge the grades because otherwise, if you don't have a 3.7, Procter & Gamble won't be interviewing you. And so there isn't a magic way by which, wink, wink, I'm going to add grades to your final grade. So there is a bit of that because a lot of the students, regrettably, end up being extrinsically motivated. And I'm the king of intrinsic motivation. And so sometimes that can cause a bit of friction. But luckily, very early in the course, I do set the guidelines and expectations. And so that the ones who end up staying in my course, end up seeing eye to eye in terms of what they want to get out of the course. There you have it, folks. If any of you are ever interested in taking a course with me, it's never too late to apply to pursue an MBA. I keep saying I'm going to end here, but let me just mention that in my latest book, which by the way is coming out on paperback on May 14th, it's called The Sad Truth About Happiness, 8 Secrets for Leading the Good Life. And towards the end of the book, I describe two incredible stories of people who ended up completing their PhDs in their late 80s and early 90s. And so when I get a student who comes into my office, says, "Hey, professor, can I talk to you? I need some advice." I say, "Yeah, sure, come in." "Well, professor, you know, I'm 27 and I'm thinking that maybe I'm too old to pursue, you know, fill in the blank, whatever degree." And then I tell them, "Sit down, I have a story to tell you." And then I usually proceed to tell them one, if not both, of those stories. And suddenly, them being 27 or 29 or 32 or 34 is not that old compared to someone who decided to go back to study in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. So luckily, education is one area where we can pursue, assuming God willing we're healthy of mind and body, late into our lives. And so yes, you can pursue degrees. So I hope that I'll see some of you in some lecture at some point. If you're ever in Montreal and want to maybe audit a course, shoot me an email. It's happened in the past. I've actually had fans who just wrote to me and said, "Hey, I'm going to be in Montreal. Are you teaching anything this semester?" And then they come and they sit in on a class. So Thank you so much for attending today's session. I promise to try to be a bit more routinized and offer some schedule for people to be able to, work these sessions into their schedule. And until next time, cheers, everybody, and thank you for coming. Take care.